Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Mary Tabor, author of the just-released novel, Who by Fire. My guest today is Derek Haynes, prolific author and risk-taker. He's all about breaking rules. The number one rule that Derek has broken in the so-called literary world is that he doesn't care about the so-called establishment. Here's what I mean. Derek Haynes has self-published 14 books, 12 novels, and 3 books of personal musings, opinions, in the form of brief essays. Of course, he's not alone as a self-publisher. Walt Whitman, Marcel Proust, Virginia Woolf, all self-published. But all now have the imprimatur of big-name houses that sell their books. Of course, all three had to die for that to happen. Virginia by her own hand and those rocks sewn into her pockets. Self-publishing does not have the imprimatur of legitimacy among the so-called literati. The New York Times, the Times Literary Supplement, the New York Review of Books won't even give these books a by the way. Derek, as far as I can tell before talking to him, doesn't give a damn. He has said, "I'm not very good at doing as I'm told," which probably explains why self-publishing is so attractive for me. We're about to find out more. But before we do, here's what his readers on Goodreads are saying about him. For those listening who don't know about this internet site, here's where book readers gather for free and share their love of books. Derek's new book, One Last Love That I Have Read, is a love story that takes place in a hospice. On Goodreads, where Derek has 5,000 friends, here's a sampling of reviews. Derek Haynes, as always, brings his characters to life. Each one will captivate your heart. Readers will truly enjoy meeting Bonnie and his last-minute friends who changed his life. One Last Love is so easily readable and a difficult one to put aside. On Amazon, 21 folks wrote a review, and the ratings are virtually all 5 stars. I virtually met Derek on Twitter, where he has 41,278 followers. And today I have him here with us to talk about his books, the creative process, and the publishing journey. Derek Haynes, born and raised in Australia, talks to us from Switzerland, where he lives. Derek Haynes, welcome to Rare Bird Radio.
Thank you, Mary. It's very nice of you to invite me along.
And you bring along that great accent. Derek, I'd like to begin with a question about your blog. Right now, you have a running stream of blog comments about the state of publishing via Amazon. The blog title, my listeners, is called The Vandal. The blog entry is titled, "Self-Published Authors, Get Ready, You're Being Dumped." Derek, as of today, you had 215 comments and 9 pings. You will have to tell me what a ping is. So give us the lowdown.
Well, I don't know why this blog post took off. I mean, the title is typically me. I'm an attention seeker, I suppose. But Amazon changed the way, with their algorithms, I suppose, they changed the way they promoted self-published books in October and November, and sales dropped. They've come back up since, but when you publish on Amazon, you're at the whim of a retailer, so things change very, very quickly. I don't know why this one blog post, I noticed today it had 1,300 Facebook likes, which is crazy.
I saw that too when I looked on today. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah. But I think it hit a nerve that as a self-published author, you're very small, and Amazon are huge, as are all the retailers. So you're a little minion in the pond. So you have to be aware that things are going to change rapidly, they're going to change frequently, and not always to your favour. So I suppose the whole sense of the blog was to be flexible, to be ready to change.
Eric, I'm having a little trouble hearing you. I wonder if that's also occurring for our host. Just repeat the last thing you said. Let's try a little better. I know we have a long-distance call here. Are you on a mobile phone?
Yes, yes.
Okay, maybe a little bit. Just go ahead. Go ahead.
I think it's about the fact that there's so many people in self-publishing now, and so many people have false expectations. I think self-publishing is in... You can divide it into there are people that self-publish fiction, self-publish because they want to get their stories out there, they want to be read. The other 50% are marketers. They're selling a product, and they want to make money each month. The two don't go together. So I think self-publishing has a black and white side.
Yeah.
And that one post seemed to hit on both sides. There's comments there from the people who are trying to sell a book every 90 days or a new book every 90 days to people who have one book and they're trying to sell their life story or their story of a life event that changed their lives for them. Self-publishing is not a simplistic word or a description that you can apply to every author.
And in your choices that you're making, did you try the traditional route and get discouraged, or did you just decide that this is the best way to really get your work out there?
I tried initially a long, long time ago. I was quite heartened today. I was reading that Jasper Ford was rejected 76 times before his first book was published. So I didn't get as far as 76 rejections before I gave up. But as you said in your introduction, I don't like doing as I'm told, so I probably wouldn't do well even if I had a literary agent or worked for a publisher, I would be the one that would probably be late with a book or not write a book that people wanted. We're a bit like Tom Waits. Every time he changed recording company, he would change his style, and they would hate it. That's probably me. I don't fit a genre. I don't fit a certain mold. So for a publisher that wanted to publish a book in X genre every 6 months, that just wouldn't be me.
And in fact, you're writing in a whole range of that genre is a kind of a funny word that bothers me a little bit in terms of classifying somebody in a particular way. But you are doing a whole range of things. Why don't you give our listeners a kind of an idea of the range of types of books you are writing, and then I have a couple more questions on that score for you.
Well, I don't think they're all that different. I think the settings are different. I mean, genre is just another word for product, perhaps. But I think the
that's a better
that
way to say it, yes. I just don't want to get you classified in terms of romance novel or horror or whatever, because you're doing so much, and I've been reading a lot of you.
Yeah, well, I don't think any of mine fit Louis maybe is historical fiction, or One Last Love is a romance, but it's not a traditional romance. But but I think what runs through all my books is I don't like heroes and heroines very much. I like ordinary people in extraordinary situations. And I think every book I've written is about, every novel I've written is about a character that is not particularly brilliant, not particularly bright, not your traditional hero, but they're in a situation where they have to adapt, change, manage, overcome adversity, that style of thing. So I don't think there's a genre description that you can place on that.
In Vandalism, which is a book that you're actually giving away for free, this is a book that appears to me to be a compilation of essays. That's why I said musings and essays.
Mm-hmm.
You do quote Picasso, and you say, bad artists copy, good artists steal. There's a lot of attribution of that. Good poets bard, great poets steal is commonly, I thought, was attributed to T.S. Eliot, and that Picasso had said artists theft. But whichever is right about the quote, who are you stealing from?
I think I'm stealing from Douglas Adams sometimes. Grant Miller.
You're a big fan of him. Can you tell our listeners who don't know who he is? I do know who he is, but can you give us a little background on him?
Well, Douglas Adams wrote radio plays for the BBC initially, but his genius was writing in a style that was so simplistic.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I think a four-year-old can read Douglas Adams, but at the same time, the concepts that he puts across are so deep. Basically, Douglas Adams, to me, was in his Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, was talking about the questions that we can't answer about God, about afterlife, about where we come from, where we're going. To me, he was, if you like, the circus clown. The sad face,
and discovered by the Monty Python group.
Isn't he
the only person who's ever had a writing credit on Monty Python?
Yes, it's Douglas Adams.
And so, humor is key to your work, also.
I'm sorry, it's difficult to hear you, Mary.
Humor is key to your work. Humor, satire, irony. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't see exactly satire in it, but I see a great deal of humor and a lot of self-deprecation in your characters and in your work and in your essays.
It's imperfection.
Imperfection.
Everybody is imperfect. And I think a lot of literature now, if you like, is promoting perfection. I mean, this 50 Shades of Grey phenomenon with the classical hero is very typical. People like to escape, and that's what fiction has always been about, has been escape. But I just can't write in that style. I prefer to look for somebody like Bonnie in One Life's Love. He's totally imperfect. He's a bigot. He's been prejudiced all his life, but a situation creates a circumstance where he has to look at himself and his own imperfections. And that's something I always like to highlight.
And it's a very, it's a tender story, the meeting with Madeline. And he really does begin to answer the question that you ask in your own work, who am I? You ask that question mm-hmm. in your essays, but he asks that question late in life, doesn't he?
Yes, well, that was probably, I think, the easiest book I've ever written.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think it was easy?
I had role models. Because I had role models. My father died in a hospice. One of my very best friends, well, three, in fact, died in a hospice. And watching the change in their acceptance, I think. When you're facing your last few days, the only way you can handle it is with acceptance. And I think that's what I tried to put across with Bonnie, that you just have to accept that things are like this. And part of his acceptance was accepting Madeline in the last few days of his life, something that he wouldn't have done before that.
You know, Derek, I think this, from what you just said about the way that you had role models and it was easy to write, I think it's also fairly, I got the sense that it was fairly close to the bone, if you know what I mean. That mm-hmm. it was, when I read the book, I thought this has something to do with Derek's life in some way, although I didn't know what you just told me about your father.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd like to talk to you a little bit about another writer who you may not know about, but it's something that's fascinated me. His name is David Shields, and he wrote a book. Have you heard of him?
He wrote a book
called Reality Hunger, A Manifesto. And in it, he said he's basically arguing against fiction. Now, I've just written a book of fiction that's just come out, okay? So I'm not arguing that we shouldn't be writing fiction, but he's arguing that, let me give you this little bit of a quote from him. He said, this is by John Gardner from, he's quotes a number of people. Someone once said to me, this is John Gardner's quote, quoting someone or other, discursive thought is not fiction's most efficient tool. The interaction of characters is everything. This is when I knew I wasn't a fiction writer because discursive thought is what I read and what I write for. And then Shields goes on later to say, though nonfiction has much fiction in it, as does fiction, its aims are different. The mediation between the writer and the reader is thinner. This is what I see, Derek, in particularly in the book that I did buy, that I really recommend to our listeners here. It's an uneducated view of sex, food, and politics. And there's a thinness between the reader and One Last Love, and there is in your essays as well. Do you want to argue that with me or discuss that a little bit?
Well, uneducated, it's strange. One reader put a lovely review and said, when I read this book, I just felt like Derek was talking to me.
Yes.
Which was exactly what the book was supposed to be. I wrote that so long ago. I can't remember. It was in the mid-90s, I think I wrote it. But it's something that I've been tempted to go back and re-edit it.
But you just published it recently, right? This is a fairly recent publication.
Uneducated,
Uneducated. Yes. Oh, I thought you were talking about One Last Love. Yes, The Uneducated View. Well, you published quite a while ago. Yes.
A long, long time ago. Strangely enough, it's one I just recently I've sort of had a little experiment with it. I've put it onto BitTorrent, so it's free. If anybody wants to BitTorrent the book, they can download it.
Where did they get this again?
It's on BitTorrent. And I put it there intentionally, and it's been downloaded 13,500 times in 10 days.
Well, I want to give our readers an indication of what the voice is like in this book. This is from An Uneducated View of Sex, Food, and Politics by Derek Haynes. And here's I'm going to quote you here. I'm quoting Derek. My career path in retrospect reminds me of a nursery rhyme I remember as a child. There was a crooked man who walked a crooked mile. As logical and well-planned as Mad Woman's lunchbox comes to mind. Also a term dug out from a long-ago memory. Simply listed in broad and not chronological categories, I have been a printer, a salesman, self-employed trader, guitarist, environmentally inspired society dropout, husband twice, father, poet, and ever hopeful, as yet unpublished, author, the time you wrote this. Should anyone be reading this book in a printed form and be able to verify that they have not met me, please take a ballpoint pen and correct that last entry. Simply draw a dark line through ever hopeful, as yet unpublished author and replace with well-known, successful, and extremely talented, all caps, published author.
It was a good pitch.
I love it. And I think the voice is fantastic. And I don't think you should sell it for free. I think you should sell this one for big bucks.
Well, it's strange that I've put the book for free. If anybody can manage BitTorrent on the internet, it's not difficult. But the book still sells. So for me, it's actually one thing I should say: self-publishing or publishing or writing the whole lot altogether. It's not about selling books, and I think this is where the whole point is lost at the moment. The whole focus has now become, with Amazon and Apple and everything, on selling books, and you have authors checking their sales every day. It's not about sales, it's about readership. For me, the more people that read my books, the more people that know my name, books will sell in the end. So it's more important to get the readership than it is to get sales.
Because
the message is in what you write. For me, I mean, I'm like you, I'm a teacher.
You're saying then that the reward is not financial, but
of course not.
But, yeah, okay. I totally agree with you. And anyone who's listening is thinking of going into the business of becoming a writer needs to keep their day job. Is my advice to them. Okay.
Never give up your day job if you're a writer. There's so few opportunities to make a living out of writing novels. The few outliers do well, like Amanda Hocking and John Locke and whatever. But yes, keep your day job. Writing is about being passionate about something. It is not a business. If some people get lucky, that's for sure. But that's not the point of it. I think if you go into writing novels as a way to make money, that's the wrong attitude. I think you have to go in with the passion for writing, the passion for telling a story, and the passion for being read.
And can you tell us since you are in control of everything, you know how you're doing. Do you know how many books you've sold? Can you give us any idea of how much you are being read, even though you may not be getting wealthy from this?
I've got no idea. Honestly, no idea. I mean, Amazon send me a check each month, which is nice, but it's not huge. I do much better out of my teaching. For me, it's hard to judge. I noticed today another one of my books has been pirated and is being spread around
pirated,
the internet.
Pirated, meaning someone has stolen it?
Someone has copied it and put it on the BitTorrent and spread it around the internet. Well, I think it's fantastic. That's the best news I've had for a long time. That means...
the greatest compliment is to want to be you, huh?
Well, the greatest compliment is somebody thinks that's of value to copy. The internet is about free. The internet is about piracy. John Conrath wrote about it last week. You can't escape it. If you've got the mentality that somebody has downloaded my book for free and I've lost a sale, it's not right. You haven't lost a sale. That person wasn't going to buy your book.
Mm-hmm.
They're the type of people who like to get things for free, but they're reading my book. That's good.
Yeah, you're being heard. And you know, this brings me back to David Shields for a minute, because one of the things he outrageously did was he did all this quoting, but he did no footnoting. And he was mm-hmm. published by a major house, so it did insist that in the back of the book he had to put some sort of it's like a series of anecdotes, very Nietzsche-like. These anecdotes come one after another. And so he did have to say something like, number 335 was Charlie Parker, that sort of thing. Or, you have to look in the back. He has a view that I think you share about this sense of what we own and don't own in the world.
Hmm. I look back, if you like publishing now with the e-book. I mean, the e-books at the moment are causing such a storm, nobody knows where they're going or what's happening. But I think you only have to look at the music industry, what happened 10, 15 years ago. And free music, if you like, and pirated music rebuilt the music industry. And I think that's going to happen to publishing. People are going to become popular first and then sell books. I mean, Amanda Hocking's, she sold her 99-cent books or free e-books. That was the base of her popularity. So I don't see how you become popular by charging $9.99 for an e-book at the moment. You're not going to sell enough books to become popular. Your name is not going to go out there.
So would you say then that Steve Jobs changed that world through the iPod? Is that how that happened in the music industry? Is that what you see?
Exactly. It's the iPod effect. It's been well documented that when the iPod came out, the first 3 or 4 years, every iPod was full of 97% free music and 3% paid music. And I think the e-book devices at the moment are very similar. Most e-book devices have a lot of free books on them. I mean, Amazon's KDP Select program has encouraged free books on Kindle every day. There's 4,000 or 5,000 books you can download for free. So, I mean, authors are giving away their work happily on Amazon.
Okay, let me just play devil's advocate a little bit here with you on this point. I think the argument is that this is not so good because the world is diluted with so much and there are no gatekeepers. In other words, let's just say, will we have news if everybody is reporting the news? I think you're going to have a very good answer to this one. But you could argue that it will be produced by millions of people looking out their window and reflecting on what they see, which is worlds different than a trained and experienced reporter digging into a story with everything he or she has got, right? So will we have really good books anymore if there are no gatekeepers, if we don't have agents and we don't have editors and we don't have big houses telling us what we should be reading and what's on the bestseller list?
Honestly, I don't know the answer. I think the publishing industry is in such turmoil at the moment. I don't know that anybody has the answer. It's going to take at least another 3 years to settle, at least. Probably more before we know which direction it's going in. I think a key issue at the moment is the major publishers are now opening self-publishing wings, with Simon & Schuster getting into bed with Author Solutions and all this type of thing. So, if you like, the major publishers have got a foot in both camps. They've got a foot in self-publishing and they've got a foot in traditional publishing because they don't know which one's going to work.
And what is Simon and Schuster? This is in your blog post that we were talking about at the beginning of the show. Have they issued any statements on why they're doing this, or how much it would cost an author to? Wouldn't that be vanity? What we would call vanity publishing? Because the author would have to pay Simon and Schuster.
Yeah, it is vanity publishing. It's just dressed up in sheep's clothing. It's definitely vanity publishing. And they've given it the name self-publishing to make it sanitized, because everybody likes that term, vanity publishing. But it's still going to cost you between $1,500 and $20,000 to with this self-publishing wing of Simon & Schuster. But it's still part of it all. It doesn't matter whether you call it self-publishing, vanity publishing, or traditional publishing. It's still about readers buying books. So, which
okay, if you had advice, Derek, if you had advice at this point, as we come towards this we're sort of at the half hour mark. I think we started a little bit late, but if you had advice for a young writer, or in my case, an old writer, what would it be?
Simple. Your name is your part, not your book, not the title of your book, not what you write. The simple thing for me is that if I select a book to read, who will I select? A writer I know. So Jasper Ford is going to come to mind quite quickly. If I think of another writer, who do I know? Who will I buy? You normally buy a book of a writer you know. So if I saw tomorrow a book by Salman Rushdie, I would probably buy it because I know the name Salman Rushdie, not by the title of the book. And I think that's the most important thing, is sell yourself, get your name known, then worry about selling books.
Wow, really? I think that's fantastic advice, and I'm going to try to take it and live by it. I'm not sure what. Does that mean that
Well, I know your name, Mary.
You do know my name. Yes, you do. I do. You do. Does that mean that social networking then is key to all of this? Because that takes away from the creative process. So that's a little bit of a stickler for the inventiveness.
It sucks time like crazy. But,
yeah, it does.
You have to be realistic. Media is a huge opportunity for writers, huge opportunity to get known. It's free. It's free publicity. So use it. And there's some writers I know on social media, like Claude Boucher. He's got 320,000 followers on Twitter. And he takes
You're coming close, Derek. You're getting close.
Well, no, I'm probably I take a different tack to Claude. Claude has them all on one account. I have them on seven.
Wow.
So I take a slightly different marketing approach to him. But it's still the same thing. It's strength in numbers. The more people that know your name, the better. As simple as that.
Well, I just think that's I've never had anybody give that advice, or I've never actually heard that advice, but it jives so when you think of, movie stars who can get their book published just because they're, their name is already known, so they're going to be published by a large house, no matter what the quality might in fact be of the book. So
well,
it jives in that sense. But I'd like to say something. Go ahead, Derek, please.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, the major publishers now are looking for self-publishers that have name recognition. There's no doubt that that's the first thing they're looking for, because it's so difficult to sell a book at the moment. They want a known name that they can market. The book is not that important. And Fifty Shades of Grey is an ideal example. I mean, I think it's a rubbish book. But the local news agent here in where I live in Switzerland, I saw a Fifty Shades of Grey in French bought in on Monday. It was sold out on Friday. So that's name recognition.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Really? Well, Derek, I just wanted to know, I want you to know that you helped me once a long time ago when I first joined Twitter. I had no idea what I was doing. And you've helped me today by coming on the show, and I think you're an extraordinarily generous soul in the world. And in closing the show today, I'd like to say this about you, that you, your books, your musings that I love the most, and I suggest that everyone Google Derek Haynes and get on that blog and read it and also read his books. The generosity of this interview, recall for me William Blake's words, Derek. He said, "I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's. I will not reason and compare. My business is to create." Derek, I think he was talking about you. And, Derek, I'm so glad that we've connected.
Thank you very much, Mary. It's an absolute delight talking to you.
It's been a delight, and I hope we will talk again soon. Thank you, Derek. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Mary.
Without a hand to hold, but it's all right. I'm okay. How are you? For what it's worth, I must say I love you. I'm in my bed late at night. I miss you. Someone is gonna save my heart. No one is gonna break. Everything around me turned to rust. It's 'cause I built my life on sand, and I watched it crumble in the dust. Yeah, but it's alright. I'm okay. I wanna know how you are and what it's.
but everything around me turned around. But I know all I have to do is sing, and I lift myself way up.